This is Intersection. I'm Crystal Chavez, filling in for Matthew Petty. More than 200,000 Puerto Ricans have fled the island since Hurricane Maria, with many choosing to call Central Florida home, for now or forever. Welcome centers at the airport and beyond are helping new arrivals with housing, health care, and employment. Step one is rebuilding their lives. Some are starting from scratch. But already, community organizers, politicians, and others are wondering how these new residents will affect Florida politics. As American citizens, Puerto Ricans can register and get involved with mainland politics pretty quickly. Will they be motivated to? How will this influx affect 2018 elections and beyond? How will these voters affect this purple battleground state? To explore those questions and more, we're joined by UCF politics professor Aubrey Jewett. Welcome to the program.
Great to be here.
And Esteban Garces, state director of Mi Familia Vota, a group that registers people to vote and advocates for Latino political participation. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Aubrey Jewett, let's kick things off with you. Central Florida has been home to Puerto Ricans long before Maria. Many were fleeing the island's faltering economy. So what do we know? How did Puerto Ricans in Florida vote in the last presidential election?
Well, Puerto Ricans tend to vote Democratic. Certainly, they vote a lot more Democratic than the largest Hispanic subgroup in Florida, which is Cubans. Cubans historically voted Republican and have been a big part of the Republican base here in Florida, although that is changing. But Puerto Rican Hispanics, on the other hand, have been probably at the 65 to 70% levels, what I've seen estimates going for voting for Democrats. They are considered in play by both parties. They are not so firmly aligned with the Democratic Party that Republicans have given up on them or Democrats can take them for granted. So both parties do go after them vigorously. But a big influx of Puerto Rican voters probably means good news for Democrats.
But speaking of in play, we have been seeing the state being a welcoming state, greeting Puerto Ricans as they get off the plane. Do you think voters will separate the federal and state responses to Maria?
Well, you know, they may. You know, on the one hand, non-Cuban Hispanics went strongly for Hillary Clinton back in 2016 in Florida, but Cubans went pretty strongly for Trump. On the other hand, a lot of Puerto Rican voters, at least anecdotally, I've heard say, you know, even though we don't have true representation in Congress from Puerto Rico, they don't have a congressional representative or senator elected directly from Puerto Rico. It has been said that they feel like they have one in Marco Rubio. At least some Puerto Ricans feel that way. And so it is possible, and certainly Governor Scott, who will probably be running for U.S. Senate against Bill Nelson, you know, hope so. And then, of course, in the upcoming open seat governor's race, whoever the Republican candidate is, hope so, that they are not dragged down by Donald Trump.
Since you mentioned representation, Esteban, can you talk about Puerto Ricans and how they can vote? They can't vote from the island, but they can once they get here, right?
Exactly. Once they establish the residency here in Florida, they are able to vote. But it's a completely different experience, right? On the island, there's an election every 4 years, and that's it. There's an election every 4 years. And it's a cultural experience. It's almost like a three-day, you know, set of festivities. The state invests, or Puerto Rico invests, a lot more into the elections rather than the candidates, which here it's a little bit flip-flopped. And here it's a different vibe. You know, on the cultural piece, for example, we had organizations last election cycle that started caravans through the communities where there's a heavy Puerto Rican presence to try to build that environment back up of cultural participation and the happiness, alegría is how you say it in Spanish, right? That happiness around the joyous piece of voting, the participation. But it is a different experience for the Puerto Rican that comes here. The rules are different. The parties are different. There's a lot of voter education that has to happen to make sure that Puerto Ricans are up to speed on what their options are.
So has your group started registering any new arrivals, or is it too early for that?
We started registering just Latinos in general, and amongst those Latinos, there are Puerto Ricans. We are going to have a stronger focus beginning in January for all the Central Florida region as far as the Latino population, and we expect about 50% of our voter registrations to be of Puerto Rican descent. We are not intentionally targeting, say, the relief centers or places like this. We want to give distance, and you know, people are escaping an immense tragedy on the island. So we're being cautious and respectful of that. But next year, if we catch them at a supermarket or a high traffic area where we generally find ourselves, we're happy to engage in those conversations if they're willing to engage us.
And many of these are strong Spanish speakers. Does Florida provide bilingual ballots?
To my recollection and understanding, there are not bilingual ballots in Florida. The website, I think, of the Supervisor of Elections is bilingual in Orange County and school systems and whatnot. But I don't believe that there are bilingual ballots.
Yeah, there are, but it's selective. It's only by particular counties that have more than 5% of their voting population as a language minority. So not every county in Florida has it. It's a federal regulation from the Federal Voting Rights Act. But, for instance, Orange does provide it. Miami-Dade, as an example, does. So not every county, but some do.
It's not across the board.
It is not across the board. And particularly if you move into if you're a Puerto Rican who moves into a county that doesn't already have a large Hispanic population. So, for instance, if it's not Orange or Osceola, just as an example, you may face a ballot that is English only.
Thanks for that clarification.
Sure. Yeah.
Aubrey Jewett, any projections for how many Puerto Ricans are expected to register to vote in time for the 2018 elections?
Well, that is an excellent question. And if I could give you the definitive answer, I'd probably be making a lot of money as a political consultant rather than the paltry salary as a public servant at the university. But we can make an estimate, you know. Currently, right now, if you look at Hispanic registration in Central Florida, a little less than 50% of Hispanics are registered with the Democratic Party. About 35% are registered other, meaning no party affiliation or minor party. And only about 16% of Hispanics in Central Florida, and I'm talking about the 8-county area, are registered Republican. And so assuming that, let's say, 200,000 are here now, using that as a baseline figure, not all of those folks are over 18, right? Some are young. We've seen, for instance, school populations going up. Not all will be interested in voting or want to vote, and not necessarily all won't be permanent residents. Maybe they're just going to be here for a few months and go back. But let's say 50% decide to register and vote because they're going to stay and they're going to get involved and they're going to do it, you know, within the next year by 2018. Well, 50% of 200,000 is like 100,000 people. My math's not great, but that's about 100,000 voters. And in a statewide election in Florida, where our last two presidential races, Trump won by 1%, Obama by 1%, our last two governor's races, Rick Scott, both times won only by 1%. I mean, 100,000 voters could make a real difference in a close race.
So a big enough voting block to perhaps decide an election.
Absolutely. It could be a decisive voting block if it is a close election. And that's just looking at the statewide races. You know, there's also congressional races. Let's take the congressional seat where Stephanie Murphy, who's a freshman incumbent congresswoman, knocked off 20-year incumbent John Michael last time. You know, Republicans would dearly love to get that seat back. But if it starts tilting even a little more blue, you know, they might have a lot harder time doing it. So it's not just the statewide races, but it could be a number of congressional races, state legislative races as well could be affected.
Esteban, are you seeing candidates starting to court the Puerto Rican vote with 2018 in mind?
Yes, but I'm hoping I can touch on something that Ari just mentioned previously. I think you're 100% correct, and the transiency of this population is going to be the question, I feel, to answer. Housing right now is at a high demand, so we have a lot of this influx of folks who are coming in, but the housing availability is not there to meet the demand that's present. So The question is, in these very centrally populated areas like Orlando or Kissimmee, if the housing is not there, then where are they going to land, right? Are they going to land further north, maybe in Seminole County, in those pockets where maybe Stephanie Murphy is present and represents those areas? If there's housing solutions present there, we might see that happen. So it's something that we're keeping an eye on, because the question of transiency and how long they're going to be here is going to be key for any candidate who's running for office in Central Florida or statewide, because that's the question, right? Are these folks going to stick around for November, and are they going to vote?
Registering people is one thing, but let's talk about motivation. Some people who didn't just, you know, lose their house and move to a different place aren't even motivated. People will have to do the get out the vote campaigns to get people who may not be thinking about voting next year.
Absolutely. And you know, part of the importance of these elections and the fact that it's not happening every 4 years like in Puerto Rico, it's going to be voter education, right? How does voting in 2018 affect me as a voter if I'm Puerto Rican, right? You know, not too long ago, a couple of weeks back, I took a Lyft to the airport. My driver was a Puerto Rican, of Puerto Rican descent, has been here 4 years. We started talking about politics, and, you know, he talked about how frustrated he was with Donald Trump throwing paper towels at a crowd in Puerto Rico. And so we explored that a little bit. And then he asked me, well, and what party is he, Donald Trump? And so, you know, it's this his mind in the, you know, the politics that he understands is commonwealther or statehooder or independent. Right. That's the three parties mainly that are in Puerto Rico. But here it's a totally different system. So the voter education piece, how people are personally impacted by the politics, what's happening on the island, is going to be key to making sure that people come out and vote. And if I can add one more thing on there. We did a focus group last year of newly arrived Puerto Ricans, so before Hurricane Maria, and to see what motivated them to vote. And really, the link that arrivals to this state have to Puerto Rico is undeniable, unquestionable. They always identify as Puerto Rican. Part of the focus group asked, do you identify as Latino, as Floridian, as an American citizen, or as Puerto Rican? And 9 times out of 10, they identify as Puerto Rican before anything else. And what happens on the island is a big motivator we found in this focus group to get them to want to be involved in politics.
Another big election, Democratic U.S. Senator Bill Nelson will defend his seat next year. Governor Rick Scott is expected to be his challenger. He's taken a different approach from Trump. How might Puerto Ricans influence the Florida Senate election?
Well, certainly they could have a big impact. And certainly both Bill Nelson and Governor Rick Scott know that. And so they've been acting accordingly. You know, Bill Nelson visited the island. If my memory serves me, Rick Scott has made a big point of having an outreach to Puerto Ricans who are coming to Florida and trying to say, you know, we welcome Puerto Ricans. We're trying to make it an easier transition. Making rules for schools, for instance, and universities for in-state tuition and other kinds of things to try to ease that transition. You know, hopefully some of that is because, you know, he's just trying to do the right thing and trying to help people in need. But certainly as political season and election season, as I always tell my students, you can never know people's true motivation, but always assume that a politician running for re-election has a re-election motivation as well. So bottom line, Scott and Nelson are both going to be going after all voters, but particularly Puerto Ricans, and particularly these 100,000 or however many actually registered to vote for this next election.
And you actually, your group, Esteban, tries to get people registered. And what works with these voters? Is it campaign ads? Is it door knocking? What have you found to be effective?
It's going to be a combination of a few things, different types of outreach from mail to door knocking, phone calls. We try to layer in the different types of touches to any population that we reach out to of Latino descent. But the messaging is going to be key. So we're looking to do another focus group on recent arrivals after post Hurricane Maria to find out what message resonates with them the most. You know, last year we were able to register just above 34,000 voters. Half of them, based on our trends, we believe were of Puerto Rican descent. It's not a mandatory thing to capture. So potentially it's an optional field is what I'm trying to say. We register 17,000 Puerto Rican voters to you know, with the potential to vote. We're hoping to do something on a little bit of a smaller scale this year. But as far as motivating them, it's going to be a combination of things. We even have a voter brochure that we created specifically for Puerto Ricans that explains the similarities and the differences of voting on the island and voting here, with the idea of encouraging them that it's simpler than it may seem to vote in Florida than in Puerto Rico.
How do y'all think, the Latino vote in Florida has always been the Cuban vote. Do you think that the Puerto Rican vote is going to surpass that?
I think absolutely. It's just really a matter of time. If the demographic trends continue, Cuban population is still the largest in Florida and traditionally has been the most politically powerful because they've been here for decades and have been given a fast track to citizenship and have had a shared party and policy agenda, mainly Republican and anti-communist, for a long time. And so that's given them power. And they're very concentrated in South Florida. So you can draw congressional districts and state legislative districts to elect Cuban representatives. But over the last decade, we have seen a huge shift. Really, after going back almost two decades, but particularly this last decade, Puerto Rican population was growing by 100% in Florida, and particularly right here in Central Florida. And so the hurricane really has accelerated that. And it's even possible by the next decade, by the next census, we may see that people who identify as a Puerto Rican Hispanic will take over as the number one Hispanic subgroup in Florida from Cubans.
I went to this orientation down here on Econ Trail, and this was before Maria, and many of the new arrivals that were just coming to find jobs because the economy was faltering over there already, were saying, I'm independent, I need to learn more about the candidates and the party. We know Cubans have been voting Republican. What are the issues that have made Puerto Ricans who've been here for a while go Democratic, Esteban?
Actually, and if I can take a step back with the Cuban population, I see the Cuban population as maybe three different Cuban populations, right? There's the Cuban population that before Castro in Cuba arrived here in Tampa, around the Tampa area, settled, and tend to be a little bit more progressive. After Castro took power in Cuba, another wave of Cubans that settled in southern Florida that tend to be more conservative. And then there's this third generation, I guess, of Cuban voters, the younger generation, that tends to be more progressive as well. So even amongst the Cuban population, that there's a split there.
But people are not monolithic groups, but sometimes it can help to look at trends among shared groups.
Yeah. Exactly. And here in Central Florida, from 2008 to 2013, so there's been a growth of 4.1 million to 4.4 million voters that have been added to the rolls, and 62% of that growth has been Latino. A large driver of that has been Puerto Rican. And so, going back to what was mentioned previously, some other estimates I've seen say that by 2020, Puerto Ricans will surpass Cubans in Florida as the largest Latino voting bloc if the trends continue. And it's interesting, going back to the question of Cubans versus Puerto Ricans, because Cubans have always been seen as the voting powerhouse, right? That Latino bloc that decides for the Latino community. They were previously 41% of the Latino vote in Florida, which gave them that title. But they've reduced over the years down to about 32%. And what's been increasing steadily is the Puerto Rican presence at 27% now. So it's just a matter of time before the Puerto Ricans actually do surpass the Cubans and become this new voting power in Florida.
This is transformational. We're talking about a state that has been purple, that everyone focuses on during the campaign. I mean, you had Trump or Clinton or their surrogates here all the time. Just any other final thoughts on how you think this Maria migration will affect Florida politics in the long term?
Well, I would still argue that Florida is going to probably be purple for some time to come, even with the influx of Puerto Ricans. If you just look back at the last election in 2016, where, Donald Trump won the state because of a surge of white Anglo voting and also from doing better among the Cuban population than people thought he would do, according to the exit polls. So I guess what I would remind my students is this is one trend, this big influx of Puerto Ricans. But Florida is really, not to be trite, but it is a melting pot. And so we have people come in here from all over the world and many other U.S. states, including some people who identify as Republican or lean Republican. So I would say that certainly the influx of Puerto Ricans is going to have an impact. The most likely impact is it will help the Democratic Party at least a little bit. But in the bigger picture, I think Florida will continue to be a purple state at least for several more elections.
several more elections.
So, you know, Central Florida, specifically when we talk about Central Florida, it's a swing region in a swing state that can deliver 29 electoral votes. In Osceola alone, the last numbers I've seen is that 49% of the population of Osceola County is Latino. And about 60% of that, at least back in 2010, was of Puerto Rican descent. So the Puerto Rican population, it's so important that they go out and vote. They have such a presence here. And things are on the line, such as the census, redistricting.
Certainly lots to watch for next year's elections. We've been talking with UCF Politics Professor Aubrey Jewett and Esteban Garces of Mi Familia Vota. If you'd like to continue the conversation on next year's elections, it's not too early to start on Twitter. Use the hashtag YourVoice2018. Coming up on Intersection, students in Osceola County now have a new option after high school graduation. It's already making it easier for many students to get to class. The big hope is to raise college graduation rates in the area. And later in the show, a visit to a wildlife hospital and sanctuary in Central Florida. This is Intersection. I'm Crystal Chavez. A brand new college in Osceola County. Valencia College's new Poinciana campus opened its doors this fall. More than 1,100 students are taking classes there. To check in on how this first school year is going, campus president Kathleen Plinsky joins me in studio. So it just opened. How was this first semester?
The first semester has been absolutely fantastic. The Poinciana campus opened in August, and we're just completely thrilled that they have the opportunity to pursue a college education.
So tell me a bit about the need. When did you all decide that you were going to build this campus, and what were those discussions like?
Valencia has had ideas of building a campus in Poinciana for quite some time, for more than a decade. It really became obvious that we needed to accelerate our timeline when we looked at the college going rates in Osceola County. In 2010, Osceola County ranked 61st out of 67 counties in the state of Florida in terms of the percentage of high school seniors that were continuing on to college. And that really got our attention. And we started looking at, well, what are the reasons? What are the barriers that are preventing students from going to college? And frankly, there was a misunderstanding in the community about the cost of college. I think there's so much media attention on the student debt crisis. And I think it's really important for families to understand that the tuition cost of a degree from Valencia is about $6,000 for the two-year degree. You hear about hundreds of thousands of dollars of debt. And yes, it is possible to spend that much to go to college, but it's also very important for families in our community to know and understand that you can get a college degree for under $10,000 right here in our community. So one of our strategies was simply sharing that information more broadly.
And cost isn't the only barrier. There was also a transportation issue with students having to travel pretty far for the nearest Valencia campus, right?
That is absolutely true, and specifically for our students in Poinciana. I'll never forget the first time I met a student that I learned took the bus every day from Poinciana to the Osceola campus in Kissimmee, and her bus ride was 2.5 hours each way. And frankly, I was amazed that she was able to make that commitment and yet fully understand that there are so many others in the community that simply can't do that simply can't spend 5 or 6 hours on the bus to go to college. And so having a campus located near home was so very important.
Where is that Osceola campus you're speaking of?
The Osceola campus is located in Kissimmee. It's on 192, and it's very close to the turnpike exit right off of 192.
What types of courses are offered at this campus?
At the Poinciana campus, we offer all of the courses that a student would need to complete an Associate in Arts degree, which is the degree that we recommend for students who are interested in transferring for a baccalaureate program. We also offer 5 Associate in Science degrees that are intended to prepare students directly for the workforce. So we offer an Associate in Science in Business Administration, in Culinary Arts, in Computer Information Technology, Criminal Justice, Hospitality Management, programs that really prepare students for jobs. And then we also offer short-term training programs. They're not college degree programs. They're programs that lead to industry certifications. We recognize that for many in our community, the idea of going to college for 2 or 3 or 4 years just isn't possible. The opportunity cost is too great. And so we have training programs that last 5 or 6 weeks that prepare individuals for careers where the entry-level wage is $14 or $15 an hour. So there are programs like electronic board assembly, construction, heavy equipment. There are opportunities for those individuals who are in the workforce right now who, again, might not be able to go to college for years, but are looking for a way to advance in their career and make a more sustainable wage.
And do you see more people across age groups in those kind of training programs?
Yes, those programs are intended for those individuals who are in the workforce. Oftentimes what we find are folks who are really trying to carry multiple minimum wage part-time jobs to make ends meet. And it truly is transformational when they can find a job and make $15 an hour full-time. And many of our students, frankly, the majority of our students, are before they graduate from those programs, have job offers. There are careers that are in such high demand in our community that it really is a wonderful opportunity for them to enter the workforce at a higher wage.
You mentioned hospitality and management, and you're right there in the shadow of Disney. So could you expand on that?
One of the reasons we selected both culinary arts and hospitality management for the Point Siena campus was the recognition that many of the residents of Point Siena do work at the theme parks. So this was an opportunity for residents of Point Siena who might have some experience at the theme parks to move into higher paying jobs in the hospitality field. And so we're definitely seeing hospitality grow in popularity. And certainly our culinary arts program is quite popular and is world class at Valencia.
Kathleen Plinsky, how big is this campus?
The Point Siena campus's main building is 67,000 square feet. It's three stories. And then we also have a 12,000 square foot Center for Accelerated Training, where we offer those short-term career training programs.
Now, to go back, you mentioned that you all found graduation rates were low in that area. Is there any outreach going on specifically at the high schools?
Yes, we are in the high schools very frequently, both speaking with students as well as with families. We certainly recognize that the decision to go to college is one in which families are very involved. And so on a regular basis, we offer information sessions in English and in Spanish to help families understand, again, the cost of going to college, financial aid opportunities that are available, as well as helping students complete the entire process. So completing the application for admission to Valencia, to completing the FAFSA to help students become eligible for federal financial aid, and then also to complete scholarship applications. We find that the biggest obstacle that prevents students from completing scholarship applications is that darn essay. And so we actually will have English faculty at workshops in the evening to help students write that essay, which often is about, tell us about your goals and how education would help you get there, right? So it's an opportunity for students to really think about and express why they want to go to college. And by doing that, then they're able to complete their scholarship application, which of course also helps them afford college.
Now, this campus is in a high Hispanic population. Are there any bilingual programs?
Currently, we do not have bilingual programs at the campus. We do have a very large percentage of our staff at the Point Siena campus who are bilingual. And when students enter the campus, they are greeted by a bilingual staff person. And certainly in our student services area, the majority of our staff speak Spanish. And we do have language programs in the Center for Accelerated Training. So we have what's called an intensive English program for individuals who are looking to learn English very quickly. It's a much more intensive program than traditional ESL programs. The intensive English program meets every day during the week for several hours. It's really a full-time program.
Well, I know UCF was offering some things for Puerto Rican students, like in-state tuition. Are those types of things offered from Valencia?
Yes, Valencia is offering in-state tuition for students who are displaced by the hurricane. Yes, for Hurricane Maria, both from Puerto Rico, the U.S. Virgin Islands, as well as other islands in the Caribbean that were affected by the storm. We're also waiving the $35 application fee for students who are displaced from the hurricane as well.
You said there was a question you got a lot from people. What was that?
I did. Very regularly in the community, I was asked, why is Valencia building a campus in Point Siena? No one from Point Siena goes to college. And my response was, that is precisely why we are building a campus in Point Siena. I can tell you, again, I mentioned the student who spent 2.5 or 3 hours each way on the bus to get to the Osceola campus. There was also a student who graduated from Point Siena High School. He was going to be the first one in his family to go to college. And he was waiting on his financial aid refund to purchase a bus pass. This was several years ago. And his refund didn't process in time. And so he didn't have the cash available to buy a bus pass. He walked from the Point Siena community to the Osceola campus in Kissimmee. That's 12 miles in August, because he had heard how important it was to attend classes on that first day of school. And so I saw example after example of these students from Point Siena who were attending Valencia against almost the most incredible odds. It was as if every odd was stacked against them, and yet they persevered and they exhibited incredible dedication and determination to create a better future for themselves. And so by seeing those student examples, I knew that there were hundreds of other students in Point Siena who dreamt about going to college in the same way, but life circumstances would prevent them from making those incredible sacrifices to go to college. And so I'm just so happy that we're able to create access to higher education so much closer to home for these students.
What do you hope are the long-term impacts? I'm guessing you want to help raise those college graduation rates.
Certainly, we hope to increase the college-going rates. We have set as a goal that the high schools in Point Siena will have essentially the highest college-going rates of any of the high schools in Osceola County. And that would really sort
of... When do you hope to reach that goal by?
In the next 5 years. So that would really flip the story. But ultimately, our hope is that it also leads to really economic development in the community and really an improvement in the quality of life for the community.
You've been hearing from Kathleen Plinsky, president of the new Valencia Point Siena campus. Coming up, we'll take you down to the Florida Wildlife Hospital and Sanctuary in Brevard County, caring for injured birds, squirrels, snakes, and more. Stay tuned for the rest of Intersection here on 90.7 News. This is Intersection. I'm Crystal Chavez. We're now at the Florida Wildlife Hospital and Sanctuary in Palm Shores. Their mission is to aid injured, sick, and orphaned native Florida wildlife and migratory birds, and when they're all healed up, to return them to the wild.
So here's a baby squirrel. So he is he's in an incubator. He's got a little heating pad in there with him.
Nonprofit Executive Director Tracy Frampton is here to tell us more about the work you do at this hospital.
Well, we are here to help residents and citizens that find injured native wildlife. Sometimes it gets a little confusing because we are not permitted to release non-native wildlife. So there's only certain things we can work with, but it's a lot. So when somebody finds a baby bird that fell out of a nest, or a baby squirrel, or a pelican that's entangled in monofilament, they can call us up. A lot of times the babies are actually better if you can put them back with their moms. We do an awesome job, but we ain't mom. So many times there is an opportunity to put them back. So we do try and coach people on how to do it. It is a myth that if you touch the animal, mom won't come back. That is not true. So that is, especially in the spring, we'll be doing a lot of coaching, trying to get people to put the babies back with their mother. The monofilament situation is a totally different situation. The animal is not going to be able to get untangled from fishing line. So the best thing is to get them in here as soon as they can. We do see about 5,000 patients a year. So we have a lot of patients coming through our doors, and we never charge for someone to drop an animal off.
And I saw the drop box outside. Tell me a little bit about how that works. Is that for after hours?
Yes, absolutely. When we're here, come on in. If somebody's not right at the front desk, there's a little doorbell you ring. Come on in. The more details we can get about the situation that happened with the animal, the better. So come on in, talk to us, let us know what happened. However, you don't just find things from 9 to 4:30 every day. So if you find something in the middle of the night, bring it in. If it's in a little cardboard box that fits in our drop-off boxes, leave it in the box. That's absolutely fine. There's a little mailbox there with paperwork if you could fill out some information so that we could contact you if you have more questions. And those are checked throughout the night.
You mentioned some of the types of animals, but can you give me a bigger full list?
Sure. We are really permitted to work with anything that is native to Florida, except we can't do marine mammals. As you'll see when you walk around, we don't have a setup for manatees and dolphins. We do not do sea turtles. We are not allowed to rehab alligators or venomous snakes. We do not get many venomous snakes or alligators in here. However, we do get sea turtles pretty regularly, and we will take them, but then we immediately transport them to wherever we're told to take them to. But pretty much anything else that is native to Florida, we do bats, flying squirrels, seabirds such as pelicans, terns, gulls. We do possums, raccoons, bobcats, and lots of baby songbirds.
Are there any species that are more prevalent to come through this time of year?
This time of year, I don't even want to say it, but it's a little slow. As soon as you say that, you get jinxed and you get slammed. But we will soon be upon migratory bird season, which means that mostly the migratory seabirds. So we're going to start seeing more of the birds that are coming down from the north and are absolutely exhausted from their trip. And sometimes other conditions take over when they're weakened from migration. So we'll start getting more gannets, pelicans. One year we had a couple years ago, we had about 170 pelicans come in within a 2-month period. It doesn't smell quite as fresh in this building when we have that many birds that eat fish, as you can quite imagine. So you can also tell when it's seabird season as soon as you walk in the door.
Now, is the main issue that you see this birds and animals getting wrapped up in fishing line?
A lot of it is that. A lot of the seabirds are just exhausted. They start getting weak. When they get weak, they can't catch food, so it's sort of a catch-22. Many of the seabirds that come to us are not typically found on land at all. So if they're sick enough, weak enough that they have washed to shore, oftentimes their organs have already started to shut down. They're half their body weight. A lot of times we can't even help them. They're too far gone. But occasionally we do have luck.
So is that how most animals get here, is by people bringing them, not you being out in the field looking for them?
That is correct. Our staff concentrates all their time on here taking care of patients. Many times there can be over 100 patients in the nursery at one time, and some of those patients are being fed every 15 minutes. So you can imagine we're a little busy here and aren't able to actually go out and rescue. There is another nonprofit that only does transport. They don't just bring them to us, but they take them to other places as well. They're called Wild Florida Rescue. And actually, they just left, had something, I'm not even sure what they brought in, about 15 minutes ago. So they're here fairly often. And so they are a separate nonprofit. But most of the animals that come are from people that find them and bring them in to us.
So you mentioned, gosh, feeding every 15 minutes sometimes. Like, how many people work here, and do you take volunteers?
Excellent question. We have 12 staff members, and we have over 70 kind of regular. We have more than that, but about 70 regular volunteers that come in. The volunteers do a lot of cleaning. If you don't like laundry or floors, probably not the best place to start, because that's a lot of what they do. The washing machines start first thing in the morning and usually don't stop until we leave at the end of the day. They're going all day long. But we could not do what we do without our amazing volunteer corps. We also have a team of volunteers that do programs and go to festivals and work with our ambassador animals. We have volunteers that work the front desk. We have volunteers that help with animal care. Usually you don't start out in animal care right away, but once we feel like you're committed and can follow all the rules, then there are some opportunities to start helping with animal care.
There's a photo of a little squirrel on your Facebook page that says you have to get creative when feeding some of your patients as they get older and more feisty. What are some examples?
Well, that was a good example. Sometimes the squirrels come in and they're old enough that they don't like people, which is really what we want. We want these patients to not like us. That is the way it should be, because then we know they're going to make it in the wild. If they start liking us and reaching out to us for food, then they're probably not going to have as much success in the wild. So when that happens, then we've got to, you know, watch our fingers and protect ourselves. And so that was a perfect example of the kind of feeding him where he was instead of pulling him out. Usually with the baby mammals, they're weighed every morning. So he's, at some point, you're going to have to handle him. But if he's getting four feedings a day and he's really feisty, then there are ways to feed them without actually handling them. Because, of course, we want staff and volunteers to be safe.
So y'all do x-rays on site?
We do. We just recently got an x-ray machine. We've been without an x-ray machine for about 4 years. And as you can imagine, they're very expensive. We could have found one that is the old style, kind of like the old film camera. But we really wanted to move to the modern age. So we did find a reasonably priced used x-ray machine that was in great shape and came with a great warranty. That was one of the other issues, is finding them with good warranties. It came with a great warranty. So on October 31st, we got our x-ray machine, and it has been used multiple times every day since.
So how do you get a wild animal to stay still enough for an x-ray?
Oh, good question. Yeah, you can't just say, hold still. So we usually use anesthesia. Just some gas is typically how we do it, and then get them in position where we need them. Kind of, if it's a bird, kind of hold the wings out. We do not want to expose staff to unnecessary amounts of radiation, so we can use tape or different things to kind of hold the animal in position so that the staff can step out, take the x-ray, and then walk back in. And it is a DR system, which means it immediately shows up right on the computer. So if you got a bad x-ray, you can immediately do it again.
So what are the types of things y'all do too, aside from feeding and x-raying? Like, what other types of things go into care?
It really depends. It depends on the season. Like for the seabirds, a lot of times they're, once they get really weak, then internal parasites take over. So we give them parasite treatments. We might give them antibiotics, especially if they have fish hooks in them. There is a way to actually get a fish hook out of a bird if it swallowed it. It doesn't always work, but what we do here is we take cotton and we stuff it inside the fish that they're going to eat, the frozen fish, put cotton in it, and when the fish is digested, the cotton is left in the digestive system, and as it passes out, oftentimes it will hook the hook, snag it, and it passes it all out. So they don't do well with surgery. You wouldn't want to do surgery on a seabird to get the hook out. So that's one way we can do it. And again, that's awesome that we have the x-ray machine, because then we can kind of follow it along and see if it's moving, if it comes out. So those kinds of things, antibiotics, we can do parasite treatments. Some wing injuries, we are able to put a bandage and a sling on it or whatever, and bird bones heal fairly quickly, and hopefully they heal properly, but they do, because they're hollow, they heal fairly quickly. So there are a lot of times you can wrap things. Sometimes it's a eye injury that just takes time to heal. Sometimes it's a window strike. Some of those migratory birds are coming through and they hit a window and they just need a couple of days to recover, and we can release them. And then there's a lot of the babies that we're raising.
Based on what you see, do you have any advice for people to prevent some of these injuries?
Absolutely. That's an excellent question. So for the fishing line, please just pick up your fishing line. If you get snagged on something, take the time and effort to go try and reel it in, cut it off the bush or wherever it ended up, because that is a real problem. Another thing is for windows, it's actually better if you have a bird feeder that you like to watch the birds. It's better to actually have it closer to your window than farther away, because if it's farther away and something startles the bird, it has more of a running start and can hurt itself. Where if it's really close to the window, it's so close it doesn't have enough time to build up speed to injure itself. Picking up trash is another huge one. Please recycle. A lot of these animals are ingesting trash. Balloons are a really bad thing, especially if they have a long string attached. A lot of animals think it's a something to eat and they will eat it and it can cause real problems.
So what about when the animal is ready to go, it's all healed up? What's the process for getting them back out?
So when they're in the hospital building itself, they're really in the more critical stage. When they are recovered well enough, they also need to build up their strength again. So we have outdoor enclosures that we put them in, and depending on the animal, it might be out there for a couple of weeks, it might be out there a month or so. And we do not want to release them until we feel like they really are ready to survive back in the wild, because it's a tough world out there. So we let them build up their muscles, make sure they're able to catch food. And then we have another great use of our volunteers, which is like the best part of this job, is they will transport the animals and release them. Many of the animals we try and release back where they were found. Some of them it's required by law. You have to release them within a mile of where they were found. If they were adults with a breeding territory, we definitely try and get them back near where they were found. If they were young, they're not going to know where they are anyway, so it's not quite as critical. But we do have a great, sometimes staff will do it, sometimes volunteers will do it, but we take them back and let them go again.
Have you ever got like attached to one of your patients and it's hard to let them go?
It is at times, but we all know that that's really the best thing for the animals, is to get them back in the wild. So as much as it's hard, it's also a celebration to see them go again. Now, we do get some animals occasionally that are not releasable. Some of the more common species, unfortunately, it's hard to find them a captive home. But sometimes there are species that we are able to find them a captive home, some zoos, education facilities. So we do reach out to our friends when we have an animal that seems to have adapted well to captivity and is a species that they might be interested in. We definitely try and find them some captive homes where they can be an ambassador to teach people about their species.
Yeah, tell me more. You said you have some ambassadors on site. Who are they and what do they do, really?
Yes, we do. We've got some owls and hawks. We've got a few reptiles, and they go to programs. We do school programs. We go to festivals. We will even occasionally, if somebody wants to see something and we have time and they're here, we can bring an animal out. There's also cages out front where we occasionally put the animals so people can just walk in and see them. Some of our owls have double duty. They do education programs, but they also help raise babies. And the two that we use for this are both males. We have a screech owl who is an awesome foster dad, and we have a great horned owl who we've started using with kind of a little bit older babies, not the little itty bitties. And we do have video of both of them feeding the babies. They're really handleable animals until they get babies, and then they become dad and they don't like us, and it's really interesting to watch the transition. But it really helps teach the babies how to be an owl and how to not like us, and that's what we want.
Wow, and so they'll just take to these babies naturally?
Yeah, it's really amazing to watch. They will take to the babies very well. The only thing that we really have to make sure that these babies are able to catch live food before we release them. If a hawk or an owl comes in as an adult, we know they can catch food. They're an adult. But when the babies come in, they've never had to catch live food. So part of their training process is, we call it mouse school, and they have to learn how to catch live food. It may sound really mean for the poor little mouse, and I get that, but it also would be really cruel to release something in the wild that does not know how to eat.
Well, can we go take a look at an ambassador?
Sure. Red-shouldered hawk, which is one of the most common hawks that you'll see when you're just driving around the area. There's a lot of red-shouldered.
Very popular here in Central Florida.
And this is a, Mary's going to start talking now that you walked away.
That was Tracy Frampton, Executive Director of the Florida Wildlife Hospital. You can see photos of some of the patients at WMFE.org. Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital. Education reporting on 90.7 News is brought to you by Helios Education Foundation. Intersections producer is Brendan Byrne. The executive producer is Catherine Welch. Technical direction from Nicole Darden-Creston. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Visit us online at WMFE.org. Thanks for listening. I'm Crystal Chavez.